Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Steve Early, a veteran 27-year union organizer with the Communications Workers of America and author, who discusses labor's relationship with the Democratic Party and the serious challenges facing unions today. Peter Hart of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a critical look at the corporate media's coverage of the major party political conventions. And Michael Hendricks, professor of health policy management and leadership at West Virginia University, who talks about the results of recent health studies conducted near mountaintop removal coal mining sites in Appalachia. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange remains a virtual prisoner inside Ecuador's embassy in London after winning political asylum status, his group's disclosure of tens of thousands of secret U.S. State Department cables reverberates across Latin America. Leaked cables published in 2011 revealed the heavy hand of the Obama administration in the violent campaign against drug traffickers and American unhappiness with Brazil's attempts to broker a diplomatic solution to the West's confrontation with Iran over its nuclear program. Cablegate, as the leaked communications were known, led to the resignation of the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Carlos Pascual, after a cable revealed a biting critique of Mexican generals for risk avoidance. According to The Nation magazine, the disclosure embarrassed the Mexican generals and caused a rift in U.S.-Mexican relations. The WikiLeaks cables also exposed attempts by the George W. Bush White House to enlist other nations in the region to spy on Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez. Many observers say the secret cables are only the tip of the iceberg of U.S. intervention in Latin America. In Brazil, perhaps the most important and lasting effects of the WikiLeaks disclosures may be the establishment of new independent media outlets willing to expose official secrets. A new nonprofit center for investigative journalism based on the U.S. group ProPublica was formed to promote the sharing of groundbreaking investigative stories. Now Brazil's big TV networks like Globo are eager to sponsor the annual gathering of the Brazilian Association of Investigative Journalism. A new glut of natural gas driven by the controversial extraction method known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, has shaken up U.S. energy policy and increased pressure to phase out older, dirty coal-burning power plants, which produce more toxic emissions than newer ones. Over the summer, a report by the U.S. Energy Information Administration found natural gas tied with coal for the first time as the leading fuels used by U.S. power plants. With stricter air quality standards for new power plants from the Environmental Protection Agency, coal now faces new economic hurdles. The report estimates about 17% of all coal-fired power plants could be retired by the year 2020. Optimists also note carbon emissions from the U.S. energy sector have fallen to the lowest level in 20 years. Today, a new natural gas plant produces 30 to 50% less carbon emissions than a conventional coal power plant. Energy analysts see natural gas as an improvement, but not a real solution to address the urgent issue of climate change. Natural gas produces methane, a major greenhouse gas. However, even with the increased use of natural gas in the United States, predictions of rising global temperatures of 3.5 degrees Celsius by the year 2050 remain unchanged due to the increased burning of coal in China and India. In the longer term, clean energy advocates worry that cheap natural gas could reduce investment in a new generation of wind and solar energy production technologies. As college students head back to campus this fall, there's growing concern that an undergraduate degree is no longer enough, and students are seeking out alternatives, including programs that combine a bachelor's and master's degrees. Some young adults are deciding to skip the traditional four-year college degree altogether, opting instead to enroll in trade schools and affiliated internship programs. By 2020, American colleges expect to hand out 2 million undergraduate degrees. Typically, a college graduate earns 66% more than a high school graduate. But in the current economic downturn, there are an increasing number of college graduates who find themselves working as taxicab drivers and bartenders. A recent study of global work skills conducted by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development found a pronounced social stigma attached to vocational education in the United States, and many manufacturers are finding there is a shortage of skilled blue-collar workers to fill positions like welders and machinists. But as these shortages of trained workers become acute, cuts in state budgets are forcing many community colleges to drop occupational courses and certificate programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Over recent decades, the U.S. labor movement has lost millions of members, weakening unions' ability to negotiate for higher wages and improved benefits. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the percentage of the workforce belonging to unions was 11.8%, or 14.8 million workers, in 2011. In 1983, the percentage of workers belonging to unions was 20.1%, with 17.7 million union dues-paying members. Although public sector union membership was in a stronger position, comprising 37% of the workforce, public employee unions are facing aggressive attacks from Republican state governors and legislatures, with new laws revoking their right to bargain collectively and a large number of layoffs. As Democrats from across the nation gather in Charlotte, North Carolina for their national convention, some friction between labor and the Democrats was evident over the selection of Charlotte as the city hosting the party's nominating convention. Charlotte is a staunchly anti-union city, and North Carolina is arguably the most hostile place for unions in the entire nation. But long simmering issues have played a more important role in the cooling of relations between unions and Democrats. The Obama administration did little to advocate for the union-backed Employee Free Choice Act in Congress, legislation that would have made it easier to organize in the workplace. There's also been anger over Obama's push for new free trade agreements with Panama, Korea, and especially Colombia, a nation where labor organizers have routinely been murdered with impunity. Your reporter spoke with Steve Early, a veteran 27-year union organizer with the Communication Workers of America, and author most recently of The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. He discusses labor's relationship with the Democratic Party and the serious challenges facing unions today.
Well, I think for many decades now, every 4 years, union members find themselves caught between a Republican rock and a Democratic hard place. Clearly, you know, Romney and Ryan and what they represent, they would turn back the clock to the unbridled union bashing of the Bush and the Reagan years. On the other hand, the President Obama's first term has been a disappointment for many workers and union activists who supported him very actively 4 years ago. Obama, in his pursuit of bipartisan solutions, has blurred a lot of the traditional political differences between the two parties on issues related to labor and the economy, to corporate power, to free trade, to federal budget priorities. So the turnout appeal among labor to reelect Obama, to keep Democrats in Congress, select a few more of them, is really more and more an appeal to lesser evilism, you know, not the more inspiring call to arms around change you can believe in, which was change that people did believe in 4 years ago. 4 years later, I think it's more the fear of what the Republicans would do if they got in than any great hopes for another 4 years under the Democrats producing a more supportive environment for unions.
When you look at some of the issues most important to labor and the Obama administration's failure to follow through on them, I know the so-called card check legislation was one of those elements, the Employee Free Choice Act, as it's called. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the card check legislation, what happened to it, and how, again, it may be symbolic of the wider rift between the Democrats and the Obama administration in labor.
Sure. The AFL-CIO, unions affiliated with the other major labor center, Change to Win, all of them had been campaigning for 2 or 3 years prior to Obama's election 4 years ago for private sector labor law reform being a very high priority of the new Democratic administration. Obama, as a candidate in 2008, repeatedly pledged to support strengthening workers' rights to organize and bargain in the public sector, to increase penalties for employers who committed unfair labor practices and fired workers who tried to form or join unions. When he got into office with considerable majorities in both the House and Senate, he instead made health care reform his top priority, and labor law reform was backburnered. And, of course, when the Democrats lost their control over half of the Congress 2 years ago, for the time being, at least, strengthening workers' rights became kind of a moot issue. I think the Democrats are very uncomfortable, really, with being seen as strong defenders of collective bargaining, even though that could have been a very important part of their whole approach to the economic stimulus that was much needed to put millions of people back to work and increase their purchasing power, enable them through expanded rights on the job to deal with their employers about issues related to wages and hours and working conditions. But the Democrats have strayed very far from the administration Franklin and Delano Roosevelt back in the 1930s, when there was an understanding that, that collective bargaining is a social good. It helps empower people in the otherwise very uneven playing field of labor-management relations.
Steve, what's your take on Occupy Wall Street and the inspiration it certainly provided some sectors of the labor movement to again engage in militant tactics on the street to grab public attention and support? Is that something that's going to be long-lasting, you know, beyond these encampments that were raided around the country last year? Do you think we're going to see a labor-Occupy kind of alliance move forward in the future?
Well, I think in some places there were, certainly New York City, local Occupy labor committees that came together that were kind of cross-union bodies representing with rank and filers from different unions who gravitated towards the occupation sites there and elsewhere and wanted to link the energy and the idealism and the direct action militancy of Occupy to ongoing local and national and regional labor struggles. Certainly, some of my brothers and sisters who were on strike last August in Verizon, when they went back to work without a contract, they were feeling kind of down in the dumps, and then Occupy came along, and they participated in marches and rallies. They really got a boost in their fight, as did Teamsters and teachers and other people in New York City. So I think there's some very important kind of alliances and relationships formed as a result of the cross-fertilization and the fraternization that went on among people who otherwise, you know, operated in very different spheres and were part of very different kind of political cultures and might not have even thought they had as much in common as before Occupy came up with this brilliant framing of the 99% versus the 1%.
That was Steve Early, a veteran 27-year union organizer with the Communications Workers of America and author of The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. Learn more about the challenges facing the labor movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Republican National Convention was preparing to launch in Tampa, Florida, the specter of Tropical Storm Isaac threatened to wash out the proceedings. But after a one-day delay, the televised nominating convention got underway with the focus shifting from the weather back to the predictable rhetorically heavy speeches. But while Americans widely expect politicians to bend the truth to put themselves and their party in the best possible light, the GOP convention this year was notable for the long list of exaggerations, misleading statements, and blatant lies cataloged by a small army of fact-checkers, many on the web. Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan, the Republican vice presidential nominee, seemed to break records for the number of misstatements made during his acceptance speech. Among them was the claim that President Obama broke his pledge to keep a GM plant open in Ryan's hometown in Janesville, Wisconsin. Documents show Obama never made that promise, and the plant was shut down in 2008 under President Bush's watch. Another issue of veracity arose when Ryan repeated the statement that the Obama health care plan took $716 billion out of Medicare, not bothering to mention that these cuts were made to the reimbursements paid to health providers and hospitals, unlike Ryan's own proposed $716 billion cut to Medicare recipient benefits by moving to a voucher system. In fact, the overall GOP convention theme of "We built this" was taken from the blatantly out-of-context Obama quote, "If you got a business, you didn't build that," which deliberately deleted Obama's direct reference to government's investment in roads and bridges. Your reporter spoke with Peter Hart, activism director with the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a critical look at the corporate media's coverage of the major party political conventions and their obligation to separate fact from fiction.
It is one of the more bizarre spectacles we have going on now. You would assume that journalists would take this responsibility seriously. There's the old saying that all politicians lie, and you might as well just operate from that premise and explain to people when and how politicians are lying. That's not the way big-time journalism works, and it hasn't ever really worked that way. The Ryan incident, I think, has really shone a light on this, because we are now in the first presidential campaign where we have a multitude of fact-checking operations, PolitiFact, factcheck.org, that kind of stuff, that are solely designed to try to sort truth from fiction when it comes to major political candidates and politicians. And so this information, I think, is washing around a lot more in the media, and it's created this kind of crisis for reporters who don't do that normally. Because, you know, again, viewing it from the outside, if someone like Wolf Blitzer is saying at the end of the Paul Ryan speech, as he did, well, there were a couple of claims there that the fact-checkers are going to have take issue with. What he's saying is that that's not what he does, that that's another division of journalism that will handle whether or not what you just heard was accurate. And I think it's a profound admission. I don't think Wolf Blitzer means it, but I think it means something. So we have this environment that we're in now, in particular with the Ryan speech, because it was so blatant. And I think journalists are struggling with how to tell people this. And a lot of media outlets still believe, and it's surprising, I think, to people, but they still believe that this is something that you don't do. There was a New York Times television critic who wrote about MSNBC, and one of her main points about the MSNBC coverage was that they were talking about lying. And she found this very unusual and recommended that reporters shouldn't put it so bluntly and so directly, that they should find euphemisms like fudge to the facts or things like that, or finesse the facts, I think was her preferred term, which again is a way of obscuring reality. To me, the most obvious part of the Ryan controversy is that this is only happening because this myth has been built around him by the media, perpetrated by the media over the last 2 years, that says that Paul Ryan is an unusually wonky budget expert. He's not. He's as much of a wonk as any other politician who works on a budget committee and who writes budgets. There are many of them that do this. But for whatever reason, reporters have decided Paul Ryan's unusually smart. And so I think they have this crisis now because they've built this person's reputation. And now anyone with an internet connection can see that, you know, when he was talking about Obama and this Janesville factory that closed down, you can see that, well, the factory closed down before Obama took office. When he chastises Obama for not taking up the Bowles-Simpson Commission's recommendations from the chair, you can find out that Paul Ryan was on that commission. He voted against the chairman's recommendations. So these things were obvious and out there. A healthy media environment would not have this kind of crisis of conscience about what to call them. They're lies, they're factual inaccuracies, whatever you want to say. But there is this problem with mainstream journalism kind of confronting that head on. And as much as that situation is improving, it's still, I think we're still a long way off from squaring with the public.
Peter, for many years now, mainstream media, particularly television news and the big newspapers around the country, have been attacked as the quote-unquote biased liberal media. Many of these institutions have been on the defensive for quite some time. So when they use the term balanced reporting, do they mean that they're not going to separate truth from fiction? When these big media outlets use that terminology, balanced reporting, are they really just ducking the hard and fast separation from truth and lies? And how do they make that excuse to themselves? How do they sleep at night? These guys are pulling down major salaries, and they're not telling their viewers or listeners or readers a lot in terms of where the country might be headed if this guy or that guy is elected.
I think there is a kind of ideology in the press that isn't left or right. It's sort of status quo, and the status quo is that you,
quote a Republican and you quote a Democrat or their equivalents, and that passes for good reporting. There was an NPR reporter, Andrea Seabrook, who quit, I think, a couple months ago, and she's starting this new startup, and she did an interview with this newspaper/website, Politico, and she said, you know, so much of what I did every day as a Capitol Hill reporter was record what a Democrat said and record what a Republican said, and I was being lied to every day, and, you know, I felt complicit in this. And I think it was a remarkable admission, because when you thought about it for a second, what she was saying was she couldn't just go on the air and say, politician A says this, it's not true, politician B says this, he's closer to reality. It was a remarkable admission about the limits in mainstream media. And remember, this is NPR. You know, these are the people who don't have the kind of commercial pressures to obey the rules. So you do, I think, have this kind of overwhelming need in mainstream media to appear like you haven't called balls and strikes. We like to think of reporters as umpires or referees, but they're not that at all, because a referee would make hard and fast judgments, and reporters tend to avoid that.
That was Peter Hart, activism director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Find more links to analysis of corporate media's coverage of U.S. politics on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Residents of communities near mountaintop removal coal mining operations in southern Appalachia suffer higher levels of many kinds of health problems than those living further away from such sites. Mountaintop removal is a mining method where millions of tons of dynamite are used to blast the tops off mountains in order to extract the coal seams beneath, dislodging rocks and earth which are dumped into the valleys below. Thus far, these operations have destroyed 500 mountain ridges and buried 2,000 miles of freshwater streams. While local residents can't prove their ailments are the result of mountaintop mining operations, many believe there is a direct connection. A score of scientific studies seems to back them up, and residents are now coming together to support legislation in Congress that would halt new permits for the mining practice until thorough health studies are conducted. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Michael Hendricks, professor of health policy management and leadership at West Virginia University, who was the lead author on recent mountaintop mining health studies. He explains what he and his co-authors' research revealed and what conclusion he's come to about whether mountaintop mining should be allowed to continue.
We've done this research over the last 6 years or so, and it documents that people who live in mining environments in Appalachia experience health problems at higher rates than people in non-mining environments. And these health problems cross many different diagnostic groups. So we see that people in mining environments are more likely to have some forms of cancer, types of cardiovascular disease, lung disease, birth defects, lower birth weight babies, poorer health-related quality of life. We found these effects are present for different outcomes for men, women, and children. So it's not just a problem among men who are coal miners. It's a larger problem for the community in general. We find that the health problems get more severe as the levels of mining increase. So the problems are worse where the mining levels are heaviest, and they're intermediate where mining is intermediate, and they're best where mining is absent. We find that the problems persist after controlling for the effects of other risk factors. So it's not because of smoking or poverty or age or education or obesity or other types of risks that also are related to these health problems. It's an independent effect. And more recently, we found that these problems are most pronounced and most concentrated specifically in areas of central Appalachia where mountaintop removal mining takes place. We don't yet have the direct evidence that links environmental conditions in a mining area to the specific health problems experienced by individuals. So we don't know yet that a particular disease outcome is related to environmental exposures. We know only that the people that live in these communities are at higher risk after controlling for other risks. So one of the things that we're doing right now to try to carry that forward is that we are starting to collect that direct environmental data in residential communities, in mountaintop mining environments, where people live. We're taking water samples and air samples right in people's yards, right in their homes. And we are finding evidence that dust levels are significantly higher in the mining communities compared to the control communities. Estimates of the amount of dust that's deposited into the human lung are higher in the mining communities. We're seeing that the contents of the dust that are collected from the mining environments are primarily things like silica, aluminum, sulfur, organic carbon, things that you would expect in retrospect to find is related to mountaintop removal. So we're seeing evidence that what's in the air is, in fact, the coal itself and the overburden from the mountaintop removal mining, from the dust that's raised by the explosives, by the heavy machinery that removes hundreds of feet of soil and rock to get to the coal. That's what's in the air. So we know that the environmental conditions are impaired. We know that the health problems exist, but we haven't yet studied air and water quality for the same people in the same households that we're measuring the health outcomes for. That's the missing piece. That's harder to do. It's more expensive, time-consuming, but that's where we're trying to go next.
Is that the thing that could prove the connection to mountaintop removal mining?
That's the piece that could provide that evidence, yeah. The evidence that we have so far is, even though it's still indirect, it's so substantial that to try to argue that, oh, we just have to study it more, we don't really know, we don't have good evidence. Personally, I think we've crossed that line. I think we have enough indirect evidence that we know that mountaintop removal is damaging to the environment. That is a fact. And we know that people who live in these environments have health problems in ways that are not explained by other risk factors. That is a fact. For us to argue that all we have to do is continue to study, I think is an excuse to do nothing, and that we should take responsible steps now to eliminate those environmental consequences from mountaintop removal mining.
And Mike Hendricks, how would that happen? Do you have specific ideas in mind? Do you mean just stop it?
Mountaintop removal mining should be stopped. The evidence for it is overwhelming. The evidence for it, and just in terms of its environmental impacts, put human health impacts aside if you don't believe the evidence for that is convincing enough yet. The evidence is compelling that water pollution alone that's coming off of the mining sites is in violation of existing law.
That was Dr. Michael Hendricks, a professor of health policy management and leadership at West Virginia University. Learn more about the health effects of mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.